You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Tour de France, brought to you by iWoka, flexible loans built for small businesses. iWoka.co.uk. Today, we're in Isère.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we are outside our little hotel in on the outskirts of Aix-les-Bains, aren't we, Richard? Where we have had two nights, our second night, before we move on.
We turned up here yesterday and thought this would be a glorious little hacienda for the rest day. And it has been that, but this is going to sound terrible, but destroyed a little bit by a couple of vans full of France TV employees who decided to take up residence at the pool and play very loud music and drink beer all day.
I don't want to make generalization because, you know, I've noticed in my decades as a cycling journalist that for some strange reason, you know, TV crews, when they're all together, tend to be like a bunch of Brits on holidays in Benidorm or something.
Oh, no. Oh dear.
Sorry about that. No, but I mean, bunch of, you know the kind. I mean, you know, they had about 15 beers, all of them. There's no beer left, actually, the landlady said.
Right?
Or maybe she thought it was wiser not to serve
Lionel,
more beer.
Cheer up.
And some people are.
But listen, these are very much first world problems, and let's not dwell on it.
Sure,
but
very
nice to be here.
We had a lovely day, though, Rich, because we went for a bike ride around the lake here at Aix-les-Bains, around, 55, 56 kilometres?
You descended like Mark Hershey today, and you climbed like Egan Bernal.
I'll take that, to be honest. I'll take that.
Egan Bernal yesterday.
Well, I'd still take that.
Still not bad, is it?
Still take that. It's tough old loop, that.
Oh, yeah, very hard. 700 metres of climbing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, lovely. I mean, it was really a nice ride, wasn't it?
We saw a Tour de France winner on our circuit, didn't we? We saw him twice, in fact.
Yeah. He was going a bit quicker than we were without seemingly making any effort whatsoever. Andy Schleck, it was, twiddling past us on the climb, or twiddling past me on the climb as I plummeted past him.
it's been a lovely rest day, and we're back on it tomorrow. Still lots to talk about in this race. It's not decided. I mean, I think you summed up very well last night, Lionel, that as dominant as Jumbo-Visma look, and as they have in some respects been, Pogacar is actually closer than he was at the start of yesterday's stage. So it's still very much all to play for, I think, between the two Slovenians at the top anyway.
And back-to-back mountain stages is always interesting, isn't it? Three in a row, then a cheeky little kind of off day to change the muscle groups that the riders will be using, and then the final time trial at La Planche des Belles Filles.
This is our second press conference episode. We've had more questions than we've ever had in the past, so we're not going to get through them all, but we will.
We'll do our best.
Save some of them for maybe after the tour as well. But thank you very much, everybody who's sent in a question. Before we get started, we should say, raise a glass to Lizzie Banks. Not only for producing with Tom Whalley another fantastic episode of Service Course, which came out on Sunday, looking at Tour de France tech, among other things. And I was actually blown away by what she and Tom had noticed just watching the race on the telly in terms of new tech and so on. So that's really interesting. Give it a listen. It's on our feed. But today she won a stage at the Giro Rosa, as she did last year, but today sounds like a bit of an epic. You heard from her this morning, Lionel.
I did, yeah. We asked a few questions for an episode of Kilometre Zero that's coming up this week, and I asked how the Giro was going, and she said, I'm tired already, and today we have 180 kilometres, which is just so stupid. And I just thought, when I heard that she was in a break of 7 minutes, 8 minutes up the road, never believe a cyclist when they say
wanted
they're tired.
Wanted to get over with a bit more quickly, obviously.
Yeah, it's just ingrained to lie about how you feel, isn't it? It's just how it gets into the minds of other people, and possibly even herself, you know.
Well,
talk herself down before riding.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing coverage of it if we can. The coverage of it during the stage was very sketchy indeed, but it sounds like it was a long stage and a great win. So well done, Lizzie Banks.
Maybe irritation is that sometimes also a factor, you know, in going for at least for a breakaway, because some riders prefer on the long day to spend the long day in the front than, you know, waiting, you know, lamely in the peloton. So I don't know, maybe Lizish will explain that. But maybe her, you know, irritation at the length of the stage was a factor in the reason why she broke away. And if that's the case, I mean, she will tell us probably.
As last year, she's keeping an audio diary.
She is keeping an audio diary for us, yeah.
And that will be out after the Giro Rosa's finished, obviously.
Yeah. Shall we go to our first question?
Let's.
Hi, this is Keith Martin, friend of the pod, Coventry boy, living in San Francisco. I think the tour's great this year, really enjoying the coverage too. My question is actually about how you're putting it all together. How are you getting the daily broadcasts out? How are you recording it? Sounds great, despite the wine and the cafe culture. Love to know. Thanks.
Thank you for your question, Keith. To kick things off, I don't know what you mean despite the wine. I think because of the wine, as it keeps here another chink. We'll hear about the wine that we're drinking a bit later in the episode. But how do we put it together? This year is more challenging than normal in some respects, and in other respects it's kind of the same. I imagine a similar experience to watching the tour at home, where it looks pretty much the same but just with one or two subtle differences. Ordinarily, we go to the start of a stage and we walk around the buses and interview riders and team directors, and then we drive to the finish and we watch the stage, and then we do the same again around the buses. This year, the buses are off limits. There's a mix zone where we can go and we can interview riders. That's actually working pretty well, especially if you have, you know, a couple of riders in mind that you want to speak to. You can set that up and it works pretty well. I think it might be something similar to that system might well survive this COVID Tour de France and become a fixture of it, which would be fine if it's organized well. The teams have some misgivings about that because of the advertising boardings behind the riders when they're interviewed on TV. Now they have all of the SO partners, whereas normally the teams have their own advertising boards up behind the riders. So that's a minor issue, which I don't think ASO will care about a great deal. And then we come to our hotel and we tend to watch the race a bit more closely now because we have a bit more time to watch it on telly. And then we record our episode, and that's pretty much it, isn't it?
Well, if we need to, you know, some explanation from a team director or whoever, we try to give phone calls to have, you know, an insight after a stage. We did a couple of times. You talked to Matt White one night when we were in after Monte Iguala, I think was it? Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, it was after Adam Yates took the yellow
jersey. Yeah, absolutely. We did that a couple of times. We tried to
Priva.
In Priva. Priva, yeah, absolutely. It was in Priva. So there's always time to add a little bit of, you know, value. I mean, that's one of the astonishing things in this Tour de France. We're far more remote from the riders than we are normally, but it tends to, you know, I wouldn't say work better, but it doesn't work that much worse, because sometimes when we're hanging around the buses, you get all these little bits of information, but maybe we record a little bit too much or, you know, sometimes. Anyways, it's...
I mean, we can still go on the other side of the fence from the buses and we can speak to people across the fence, which we have been doing at the start.
From what we heard from ASO, well, actually Big Boss the other day in the Clermont-Ferrand, Yann Le Mouhenner, that the setup that looks like it's going to be, you know, next year, if everything goes back to normal, life won't return to the way it was before COVID. Totally, but apparently the paddock, you know, that's where the buses are, they used to be kind of open, including to the public. If you've been to the English, you know, stages of the Tour de France in the past, at the finish, you know, I remember Harrogate. I mean, everybody was around the buses, you know. You could really be very close to the riders. This is finished. This would go away. Normally the paddock where the buses are would be closed. And barriers, and only the only journalists, the staff obviously, and the teams invitees will be allowed in, and the same setup might be put in place at the start also, which means that in the future, well, sadly, but probably the fans will be you know, kept away from the riders a little bit more than in the past.
Just a quick update from Lizzie Banks, who I made the comment that never trust her. Cyclists when they say they're tired. She said, I was tired. I spent the first 30 kilometres at the back. Not a bad day, though. I still think 110 miles is stupid. But then again, she says she also won the longest stage of the Giro Rosa last year. So maybe you're right, Francois.
She's also sent me a separate message saying that she's just realised that there was no live coverage of her stage win. That's unfortunate.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a small business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much indeed to iWalker, our title sponsor. We're very grateful to them for their support. If you run a small business and you want to find out more about what iWalker can do for you, go to iwoca.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk. On with the next question.
Hi guys, it's Jim Cotton from Oxfordshire here. Firstly, the obligatory thank you very much for all the awesome episodes. I look forward to them almost as much as I enjoy watching the stage itself. So I've got two questions. The first, which I guess is more directed towards Francois, which is, given how much priority and weight there is on the Tour de France in cycling and cycling media in general, what's the view among the French of the Giro and the Vuelta? Does it get much coverage? Is it given much weight? And the second question, I guess, is just in general about Team Sunweb. What were your expectations for them before the race? And obviously they've absolutely flourished with Cees Bol coming close and Mark Hirschi, you know, absolutely dominating the last week or so. Where do you think it's come from, and what do you see their future being? Thanks.
Thanks for your questions, Jim. The first one is directed at you, Francois.
Yeah, well, let's face it, the Giro and the Vuelta for the French generally are not much at all. There is live coverage on the same channels as as the rest, I mean Eurosport mainly, of both of them. The problem is that for the Giro is in same time as the French Open, tennis, which is one of the great rendezvous for the French public, you know, watching it from home and sometimes at work as well. So it clashes with one of the major sports events, in a little bit like Le Tour and Wimbledon. So I guess the Giro gets play. Of course, there are stories in L'Équipe, and you can watch it on several channels. But for the general public, it's not much. I mean, you know, if you ask the general public about Italian cycling, they would probably mention Fausto Coppi and Gino Bartali, and that's about as far as it will go. That's sad, but for the cycling fans, the Giro is important, but it's only for the real cycling fans. Same with the Vuelta, taking place in September when people are back at home, not back at work, and kids are back at school. So the Vuelta gets very well. Once again, it's showed live on TV and on Eurosport and other channels, but on GCN. But same as the Giro, very little play unless a French rider leads the way.
And yet, with the Tour de France in its September slot, the TV audience figures are up on recent years, which is interesting.
Yeah, because Le Tour in itself is a national monument, and people watch it, you know, because that's the main thing. It's like the Olympics. You watch them even if you don't like sports that much. So you end up, you know, for the Olympics, the French watch fencing or judo, you know, when there are sports that for the rest of the year or for the rest of the time they don't know about at all. So that's about the same.
And on the Sunweb question, on the one hand, I think we're surprised, and on the other hand, not, because I mentioned the other night that I felt that there were signs at Paris-Nice of the Sunweb approach this year, the strategy, if you like, the way they attacked that race. You know, Matt Winston, their coach, his stock has risen a lot. I saw him and spoke to him at the start yesterday in Lyon, actually, and he was, you know, having a great time and really rubbing his hands at some of the possibilities for them over the coming days as well. You know, they've got good riders in form, not outstanding riders, but riders who are quite evenly matched and can, as he said, bounce off each other pretty well. Something I didn't mention the other night was, you know, they lost Tom Dumoulin last year. They're also letting Sam Omen and Wilco Kelderman go at the end of the year, and that means that they're kind of giving up on GC, really, because Sam Omen is a great prospect as a stage race rider, and so Wilco Kelderman is a strong stage race rider as well. So they're giving up on that, and they're trying something quite different.
You mean they're going to turn Romain Bardet into a classics rider?
Well, yeah, I mean, I said that, though. Mm-hmm. I said that perhaps Bardet fancies a new challenge. I don't think that he's going to go and come to the Tour de France as somebody targeting GC. I don't think that would actually fit with what Sunweb want to do now. I think that, as I mentioned the other night, Luke Roberts said that having Dumoulin was on the one hand great because they had one of the few riders who can win a Grand Tour, but it's a huge gamble. And last year the gamble didn't pay off because Dumoulin crashed and missed out on the Giro and the Tour. And so they had almost a lost season because their leader, in whom they'd invested so much, had bad luck. And they've kind of spread the risk in having several riders, good riders, who can all kind of target stage wins. And they've got a lot of great publicity out of this tour.
Just on Matt Winston briefly, people may not know, but he had a long stint as a coach at British Cycling. 8 years, I think, he spent at British Cycling working with junior riders. Would often be probably one of the most sort of eye-catching things he would have done would be taking the junior team to junior Paris-Roubaix, which obviously held on the same day as Paris-Roubaix. And then he was sports director at One Pro Cycling for a little while before getting a move to Sunweb. And yeah, I remember speaking to him at the Giro last year, or the year before, and last year was his first year, so it would have been last year, and he was kind of finding his way, feeling his way into the pro peloton. But he's had a big impact.
Sunweb are good at picking up riders and developing them, but also coaching staff. You know, if you look at their coaching staff, none of them they're not typical sports directors. Mark Reef and people like that. Ike Visbeek was there. Luke Roberts was a good rider, but generally speaking, they have also, I mean, Mark Reef wasn't ever a rider at any particularly high level. He's one of their senior sports directors. They're an interesting team.
My impression on Barbet, to finish on him, it already decided, you know, with AG2R to give up on his Tour de France ambitions to go for the Giro. I think he won't give up on the Grand Tours totally and probably thinks he can win the Giro. But obviously in the Sunweb environment, he'll probably be happier not being with the French team and go for Strade Bianche, Liège, and 1 week stage wins. But he should have won Paris-Nice, Tirreno, or races like that, and never was quite a contender in those. So it'll be interesting as well.
If Bardet wins the Giro, will the French bother watching?
Well,
if a tree falls, good question. Nobody's around to hear it.
Good question.
Hi, team. Thanks for your insightful and informative podcasts. Keep up the good work. My question regards the Autobus. I remember years ago when Eros Poli was a rider, he was often described as the driver of the Autobus. Can you tell me, is there any particular rider that takes on that responsibility now? And also, how do they actually estimate how fast they need to ride? Is the elimination time for each stage known in advance, or does it change if the winner's time is particularly quick? Thanks.
Well, thanks for your question, Chris. We'll maybe ask our audio diarist a bit about how the gruppetto, as they say in Italy, and autobus, as they say in France.
Or no, they don't.
Do they not?
No.
They don't say echelon or domestique either.
Wow, well, we knew that. So we're learning something else new. No, what do they call the...
Le gruppetto.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
the French Italian, adopt the Italian word. Yeah, wow, yeah, that's absolutely a scandal, a national scandal. what do we call it in the UK?
The laughing group.
The laughing group. No laughing. No laughing goes on there. Well, over the years that I've been covering the sport, there would be somebody who would be in charge of making the calculation of what the time cut would be and communicating that to the riders in the group and making sure that they get in. And sometimes it would be, it would be down to a sort of 40 seconds or something, just getting in time. These days, the riders get the information phoned back to them as soon as the stage has been won, because now if you watch the graphics on the TV, the time cut limit is put on and counts down. So the riders in the last group on the road will know how far they've got to travel and what the time cut is, and they'll be able to work out from that whether they need to put their back into it a bit more or whether they're going to be comfortable.
Evening. Thanks as ever for your excellent coverage of this year's tour and for all your excellent coverage over the last few years. Your podcasts have accompanied me along lots of my life and I've really enjoyed them. I'll cut to the chase. Given the lack of the old guard at this year's tour and the appearance and performance of the new guard. Do you think we'll ever see the old guard rise to prominence again at the Tour, or is this really a turning of the page and a whole new chapter in the world of cycling? Thanks again. All the very best.
Well, thanks, Dan Skeldon, for your kind comments and your question. Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? Especially given that Chris Froome has signed with Israel Startup Nation, who have not signed him to not be a contender in this race next year. And especially if you look at the Israel Startup Nation team here, they haven't done a lot, have they? They haven't been very visible. They've been lacking a focal point, I would say, beyond maybe Andre Greipel's role in helping the Gruppetto make the time cut. That's a very cruel comment, but they really haven't been that visible at all in breaks or in any context. So, you know, they've signed Chris Froome, they've also signed Michael Woods, but they've signed Chris Froome to be their leader in this race and to try and win this race on, as we understand it, a lot of money and a multi-year deal. You know, the signs at the moment are not encouraging that Froome will get back to the level to compete, but I guess we should reserve judgment on that until after the Vuelta, where he's going to lead his team. Geraint Thomas has been riding very well at Tirreno, not well enough to win it. So I cannot see Geraint Thomas and Chris Froome, and I think that's really who you're talking about, coming back to the Tour de France and being in a position to win it. Although, you know, Geraint Thomas could return next year with Egan Bernal as sort of co-leaders, perhaps.
Maybe they can wait until the Tour de France take on our brilliant idea of a grey jersey for the over 35s, and they can target that.
Oh, Chris Froome would love that.
He's already eligible. Will be next year.
Don't forget Vincenzo Nibali, who is still an active rider and a force in cycling, even though, you know, he hasn't shown it in Grand Tours lately. I don't know. I think it'd be fanciful to see Geraint Thomas.
Nibali finished second at the Giro last year.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, Geraint Thomas finished third in the Tour last year as well. But once again, no, second.
Second.
Yeah, second. Second. So I mean, but even Tom Dumoulin looks an old guard now with all these young guns coming up. Some strange reason, the one I really wouldn't rule out is Chris Froome, because we don't know. We see the other keeping on riding, and they've had a full season last season and have seemed to be a little bit below par, but it was not the case for Chris Froome. We really don't know what he has left in himself, and he's a guy who's shown for the last decade, how many Grand Tours? I mean, he's made for Grand Tours. He knows how to win those. He has the experience. He cannot have lost totally his physical abilities and his knowledge of the race, within a year and a half. Well, let's see. We've seen late surges in careers by this type of riders. So
I would agree with that, because I think the thing often that goes is the desire. And I think the desire is there with Froome.
Yeah.
But you mentioned Dumoulin. I mean, Roglic is older than Dumoulin, actually. So I wouldn't discount Dumoulin either at this point. He's also coming back from a bad year, and I think returning to a level, and I think he'll be better next year. I agree with you, Francois. I wouldn't discount Chris Froome, actually.
Hi, Richard, Lionel and Francois. I'm Venkat from Bangalore, India. I've been listening to you for quite some time now. Talking about cycling in general, I was just wondering, as journalists, if you've come across any discussions within the cycling fraternity in Europe, Europe being the cradle of cycling as a sport and is even today the heartland of cycling. Have you come across any discussions on UCI thinking of organizing a World Tour event in India? It might be difficult for the teams in terms of logistics, or maybe the Cycling Federation of India that's not showing much of an interest. So I just wanted to know from you, what are your thoughts on organizing a World Tour event, maybe a one-day race, or maybe even a stage race, sometimes even a Grand Tour? I don't mind if that happens. Thank you.
Well, thanks for your question, Venkat, and it's fantastic that you're listening to the Cycling Podcast in India and following the Tour de France. It's one of the great things, isn't it, about the internet, that it crosses all borders and boundaries, and it's easy, I guess, for you to listen to the podcast and follow the Tour de France from India. So that's nice. The short answer to your question is I don't know. We will ask on your behalf whether there's any... I'm not aware of any kind of moves, but you do hear rumours about races starting up in, I suppose, new territories, and I haven't heard anything about India. I was in New Delhi for the Commonwealth Games in 2010, and it was one of the best experiences of my life as a journalist. It was a brilliant couple of weeks. The disappointing thing about the road race was, and I don't know the reasons for this entirely, but it was a bit like the 2020 Tour de France. It was held behind closed doors. They kept people away from the circuit for the road race, and I don't really know why that was. I never really found out the reason for that, but it created quite a strange atmosphere for the race. A couple of great races, the men's and women's races there, but the velodrome cycling as well happened, and I'd love to know what happened to the velodrome, because the building wasn't quite finished when the games were on, which sadly was the case for a number of the venues in New Delhi, and there were questions at the time about what the legacy of those Commonwealth Games would be. In fact, I'd love to hear from you what the legacy is of those Commonwealth Games, because it was a huge investment for India, and it was a huge deal having an event like the Commonwealth Games in India, and I had a great time there. But yeah, I'd love to know what the legacy of that is now. There was, you know, in the run up to that, there were a lot of focus on Indian cycling and developing Indian cycling, but what's happened to that now? I think, Lionel, you heard about moves to organise a stage race in India as well.
There was going to be a tour of India in 2013, I think, but I don't think it happened. But it would, I mean, when you think about, you know, cycling's popularity in Colombia, for example, and also the fact that races have been held in China, you know, yeah, why not? I mean, a huge country to explore would be, you know, a huge population. Obviously, in India, you know, cricket is the number one sport, isn't it, by quite some distance. And they have the Indian Premier League cricket, which kind of dominates the cricketing landscape over there. But yeah, why not have a tour of India? I mean, you know, when the UCI is looking at trying to take the sport and put it in front of, you know, larger numbers of people, well, you know, as I say, the population of India is huge. Would be the perfect place to hold a stage race. And Richard, the Indian junior team sprint team won gold at the Junior Track World Championships in Germany last year. India's first ever gold in a global cycling competition. The three riders were Isao Albon, Ronaldo Singh and Rohit Singh. And, well, I mean, a huge result for the Indian cycling team beating Australia in the final.
Hi, this is Lucy from Woking and friend of the podcast. So my question is about Hershey. I've noticed that when he's in his aero position, it looks like he's got a deliberately large bike computer mount at the front to rest his hands on. Is he using this, or is this in effect an unofficial mini kind of aero bar? And more generally, given that aero bars aren't allowed outside of TTs, how much is it possible to adapt the bikes officially or unofficially to make resting the forearms on the bars either more comfy or particularly more secure? Keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thanks for your question, Lucy. It's a good question. I haven't noticed anything at the front of Mark Hershey's bars. He does adopt a very aero position. One I was reminded of today when I was out riding with Lionel, and he was descending in similar fashion. He wasn't really. He's got a very aero setup, you know, with the very narrow bars, a topic that was discussed actually on the latest episode of the Service Course, which we mentioned earlier. And he does, you know, get the arms on the bars and get very aero, and he is obviously a very skilled descender. I was sent a tweet the other day by somebody who's launched a campaign to have that position actually banned, have riders banned from resting their arms on the bars like that. I think also when riders get down on the top tube in the way that they do for descents, to me it always looks very, very dangerous. I think Matej Morohic started that in 2013 at the World Championships. He won the under 23 road race there, and it's the first time I'd really seen it. I'd seen a rider sitting on the top tube and still pedaling, and it's kind of become very common since then. It always looks very dangerous to me. That's kind of off topic a bit. The whole issue of, you know, resting your hands on the bars and adopting that very aero position.
Well, in the 1990s, Cinelli, the Italian bike manufacturer, developed a handlebar extension called the Spinacci, a handlebar.
I had some.
Did you? Yeah. Basically a mini time trial style handlebar that clipped onto the central bit of the handlebars and gave the rider somewhere to rest their hands on, much like the Hershey Mohorich position, if we're going to call it that. And the UCI eventually banned it. I think it lasted two or three seasons, maybe.
Yeah.
And the UCI decided to ban it on safety grounds, really, probably quite rightly, because you can't reach the brakes. You're not. The weight distribution is all centralized, hit a bump on the road and you could wobble. And, you know, there was nothing to stop anyone. If the rider on the front of the peloton is using it...
They weren't actually any more dangerous than tri bars. The issue was they were used in road races.
They were used in road races, and rather than... Yeah, exactly. So if the rider on the front of the bunch was using them, fine. But then what's to stop the rider in second, third and fourth position using them, and then suddenly a touch of wheels, you can't maneuver the bike as well. And whether or not it contributed to more crashes, I don't know, but the UCI did ban the position and ban the they didn't ban the position because obviously riders are ingenious and have found other ways to adopt a similar position, but they banned the Spinacci bars.
Yeah, well, you remember from the very start of the triathlete handlebars, you know, that Greg LeMond used for the first time in 1989, the discussion has been raging about this kind of position and how to best achieve it. I was thinking that, you know, maybe Roglic should try it with his arms behind his back in ski jumping fashion. Well, who knows?
fantastic.
Shoot à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
The Next Generation Watt Bike Atom is sponsoring all of our Tour de France coverage this year. And while we've been here in France, Lionel, you've been talking about little else but your winter training plans.
I wouldn't say little else, Richard, but I have been inspired by Watt Bike's Hub app, because I was looking through the training plans on there and they have something to suit everybody from beginner right up to really experienced riders. I suppose it's a bit like having a coach in your pocket, setting your sessions and telling you when to train, when to take a rest day. There's a base plan for novices, so really anyone of any level could use the Watt Bike Hub app to prepare for a specific objective, whether it's a sportive or a multi-day event like the Haute Route or something like that. A lot of the plans are 13 weeks long, so you're in for the long haul. You get three or four rides a week, mixing intensity with recovery and also factoring in the rest days. And I was inspired by your recent 100-mile ride, Rich, because although I've done quite a lot of cycling this year, certainly compared with recent years, I still feel a little way off the days when I could knock out a 100-mile ride and feel reasonably good at the end. So I've set myself a little target for the winter, using the Watt Bike Hub app to build up to being able to do a 100-miler.
I think there's been a misunderstanding if you think I just knocked it out, Lionel. Well, if you want to be like Lionel and train over the autumn and winter for a specific goal, check out the Watt Bike Atom, which is available now from £90 per month from wattbike.com. That's wattbike.com.
Hi, guys. This is John Hassel from New Jersey in the States. I'm curious how you think things would stand in general classification if Roglic and Pogacar had come into this tour with their places swapped. Pogacar leading Jumbo-Visma and Roglic with UAE. Or, if you don't want to indulge a hypothetical, let me ask it this way. Whose performance has been more impressive when you consider the contributions of their teams to their current standings? Thanks a lot.
Okay, John. Well, I think if Tadej Pogacar was in Jumbo-Visma, he would win the tour. There we are.
Wow, that was quick.
He's better than Primoz Roglic, I think, and he's in a weaker team.
Would he have attacked as much if he was in Jumbo-Visma?
No. But he wouldn't need to.
He might not. He wouldn't probably have lost the time in the crosswind
stage.
There
we are.
I still think, and I famous last words, and everybody will you know, laugh at me probably in a week's time, but I think Tadej Pogacar is going to win the tour without being in Jumbo-Visma, which is the best answer to your question, I guess, if it's true.
Hello, Cycling Podcast. Joss here from Glasgow. Wondering about the ongoing, pretty alarming Twitter feud between Monsieur Tomaso and Mr. Freeb over French versus Italian cuisine. Wondering if we could get those two together, maybe for a coq au vin followed by a tiramisu to sort this out.
Well, Francois, this is the feud between French cuisine and Italian. What's Italian cuisine? Cuisine's a French word, no?
It's a French word, yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, have Italy even got a word for...
Cucina?
Cucina, yeah, cooking, kitchen.
Well, I mean, the fact that the French own the word for fine food tells us all we need to know. Yeah, I'm only saying that because I'm sitting beside Francois. If I was sitting beside Daniel, I would be defending it.
I mean, it's a pointless. I think the main dispute is this one. I love Italian food. I really love Italian food. It's great. It's absolutely brilliant. I love Chinese food. I love Indian food. I love Scottish food. I love haggis. I also love, you know, English food. I mean, you know, Yorkshire pudding and steak and kidney pie and I love all kinds of food, right? Because I love food and I have an open mind, I have an open stomach, and I'm ready to embrace all sorts of different tastes and different, you know, way of making food. I think it's the most important part probably of human culture, the differences in cooking meals and doing stuff. So I'm not a monomaniac at all, and I in a way pity Daniel very much, because for me saying there's only Italian food and the rest is crap is like, you know, having sex always in the same position. You miss a lot about life, and that's all I have to say. So no. So yeah, great, you know, Italian food is brilliant, French food is brilliant. Try every kind of, you know, food you can, and well, I don't know about your sex lives, but just really try different sorts of positions.
A parental warning in just before that. We're obviously neutral, Lionel.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I love the food when we're in Italy, but when I travel around the Giro with Daniel, he has a method. He knows where he's looking, he knows where he's going, what he's aiming for, and he knows what he'll find, and he knows the secret. When we were here on the Tour de France, and in recent years traveling with you, Francois, you've helped us unlock the door. You've helped us steer
That's
away
true.
From the obvious traps, and I now recognise them for myself. You know, it can sometimes be as simple as the awning on the restaurant is old and faded and doesn't look like any care has been taken, and the menu is laminated plastic. You know to steer away from these places on the town square next to the railway station, and it's just about unlocking the secret. And then when you do that, you discover the best that France has to offer.
Hello, Lionel, Richard, and Francois. Thanks for your amazing podcasts. Lee Townend here, friend of the podcast. My question, as things hot up going into week 3 in the big Alpine mountains, is who is your outside bet for third? It looks like a two-horse race for the podium between Rog and Pog. It really is spicing up for who's going to take that third position. A lot of strong riders showing strength. Adam Yates, people like that. I would love to see Richie Porte do it. I think he's riding strong and looking really good. But based on how it's all looking and the size and the amount of mountains still to come between here and Paris, who's your outside bet for third? Thanks.
Thanks for your question, Lee. It's a great question. Outside bet, I suppose they're all outside bets for third, aren't they? The riders who might finish on the podium. Who's yours, Lionel?
Miguel Angel Lopez, I think, will finish third. Simple as that.
Wow.
Rigoberto Urán will finish third.
Well, I think, actually, Lopez as well. But because you've picked him, I will go for Richie Porte as well. Oh. I mean, the time trial will suit him, you know, if it's close. He's rejuvenated, Richie Porte. So What a fantastic result that would be for him to finish third. I'd be pleased for him.
Hello, Richard, Lionel and Francois. Great coverage of the Tour de France as always. And in old radio parlance, long time listener, first time caller. But my big burning question I have for you all is, how is Lionel getting on with his Panini sticker book album? Thank you.
Well, Neil, I would say I'm about 58% completed, and I have hundreds and hundreds, have hundreds and hundreds of swaps. I mean, one batch, I got 3 Gregor Mühlbergers in, like one in each packet. It's a swizz, this. I mean,
nobody needs 3 Gregor Mühlbergers.
I can see why Francois's rates for writing little paragraphs of text were so high, because they're rinsing me, Panini.
Well, did you at least read my fabulous text?
No, I'm too busy trying to stick the stickers in very straight. I've got a couple that are a bit wonky, and it's playing with me.
Where's the hot spot for Panini stickers? Is it because school playgrounds used to be the place for the football stickers. Maybe we'll drop you at a school playground one day, Lionel, and go in there with your little bundle of stickers.
Can you swap these days with this, that social distancing?
Excusez-moi.
Well, I've already promised my swaps to a couple of listeners. Moyen Islam is one, and another listener wrote to us.
Gregor Mühlberger.
Yeah, but I hope you put, you know, gel on each one of your stickers.
They will be disinfected before I send them off, yes. Don't worry. But I'm hoping to complete it. I'm looking at the services tomorrow to buy another €40 worth of stickers.
Don't worry, friends of the podcast, your subscription money is not going into Lionel's.
I'm spending my own money on this.
Lionel, given all your swaps, we could maybe offer one of our listeners a second 58% filled Panini album, because you've probably got two there.
I'm looking forward to filling a whole page with Gregor Mühlberger.
Hi guys, this is Paul Weston from Newmarket, just outside Toronto in Canada. Really enjoying the coverage as always. Last year I was in Harrogate for the World Championships, and on the Friday afternoon I went into Betty's tea shop to get out of the rain and ended up sitting at the table next to Richard, who was having a chat with Lizzie Banks, and I was fortunate enough to get involved a little bit and got a few great photographs. And I was just wondering, because Betty's is synonymous with the Harrogate cycling scene right on the finishing straight for the World Championships, if you have a favourite and notable coffee shop, tea shop, bar, restaurant that you'd associate with each of the races that you attend. Anyway, thanks, and keep up the fantastic work.
Well, obviously, as we said many times, I mean, and it's mine, so I've kind of forced my comrades to like this restaurant, because if they don't, you know, they'll be in trouble. Anyway, yeah, Le Viscos, and I know lots of friends of the podcast and listeners have, you know, when they went to the Tourmalet, Otakam, or Aspin, I mean, all these, you know, all in the same area, have tried the Le Viscos. So it's in Saint-Savin, not far from Argelès-Gazost, and it's it's in the middle of all these mythical Pyrenees passes, and yeah, it's they're nice guys. The food is absolutely gorgeous. The area is nice, and the one of the guys there in charge, Aurélien, one of the two sons of the landlord, yeah, is actually in charge.
Sorry, there's the Jumbo Visma train going past again on their rest day.
Yeah, he's one of the leading members of a gravel, the Gravel Pyrenees club. So if you're into gravel, you want to
Grod.
Be in the Pyrenees, go to the Viscos, if only, well, for food, yeah, for sure, but also to ride your bike in the gravel.
Shout out, one of my favorite meals on the tour over the years, Francois, was at your friends Peter and Virginie's house,
where
we had curry.
Yeah, that was great.
Wow,
wasn't it?
That was great. Just very, very welcome indeed.
Not sure
it?
They're open to the public though, are they? Unfortunately,
well, they were. It was.
I think they couldn't sell their place because of the coronavirus situation. So I think they're still there. So it's just outside Millau, and it's called Le Petit Château. Look it up on the internet. They're probably, and if you go same riding or visiting Aveyron and the Millau region, well, just, you know, get there. It's as you discover this great area
to get there.
No, it's not easy to get there by car, but it's nice to get to ride around there. On gravelly roads again.
Hi guys, this is Rob from the UK. I always enjoy your discussions of legendary riders and stages from the past. And I was just wondering, who do you think would win a cycling history pub quiz between the members of the cycling podcast team? Feel free to rank Daniel too in his absence. Thanks very much.
Well, I think I would finish third. If it was me, you, and Daniel, I feel.
Depends what the questions are.
Well, obviously. I mean, if they were questions, you know, I knew the answers to them, I'd probably do very well.
I think I'd do better than Daniel on aspects of anything related to British cycling,
well,
Britain.
Exactly, yes.
I'm quite good on sort of tour history, I think, but he'd trounce me on the Giro.
And on certainly mountains and things like that. That's his specialist knowledge, isn't it? Anything that was covered by Cycling Weekly in the late 80s and early 90s, I know every issue pretty much off by heart, so that'd be fine.
So
who
when
won the bar here?
The funny thing about
round two,
about
the Essex Grand Prix, Richards.
The funny thing about these things is, you know, well, as you know, kind of a expert in cycling or historian of cycling, you know more about the races you haven't covered than the ones you've been at. But for very strange reason, the memory is not the same. You remember feelings, you remember events, but you just kind of, the name still kind of slip, you know, out of your mind when you've actually covered the race. So, well, so personally, I've been covered the tour for the past 30-something years. I'm terrible at those tours. I'm very good with 1920s and 1930s tour because I wasn't born.
Well, a little shout out here, a little plug for the Kilometre Zero episode with Chris Thompson, the historian who wrote the book, The Tour de France, Cultural History. And I, reading that book, I learned so much that was fascinating about the origins of the tour, the 1920s and the Pelissier brothers, and the 1950s especially, actually, in that era with Bobby and Coppi and Bartoli, well, a bit before then, Cobley, Kubler. Just fascinating. And, it was a very good book for sort of levelling up every year. You find yourself, I think, as I said in the episode, as interested in the 1925 tour as the 1995 tour, probably more so because the 1995 tour was pretty boring. But, you know, some of those stories and some of those races, and when he puts them in their historical context, as he does so well, you become so interested in it, and it's a great book for learning about the tour over its whole history.
Yeah, one thing I can tell you about the Metz guy, Romain Metz and Sylvain Metz, none of them were ski jumpers.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast, as they've done since the 2016 Giro d'Italia. If you wanted to get 25% off all your Science in Sport goodies, and they saw me around the lake today, Lionel, I had a little sneaky caffeine gel.
I thought you might have done.
Dancing on the pedals there, and it wasn't all on bread and water, you know, Lionel.
Interesting.
A little bit
interesting.
Of help there from Science and Sport. If you want 25% off, go to the website scienceandsport.com and enter the code Francois.
SISCP25.
Fantastic. Well done. Next question, please.
Hi, Richard, Lionel, and Francois. I'm Julian from Belgium, living all the way in Singapore. Really enjoying this year's tour and loving the podcast as usual. I have a question about the King of the Mountains classification, and I wondered what your thoughts are on it, because I seem to remember, you know, when I first started watching cycling when I was a kid, going back 30 years ago now, but, you know, teams took it really seriously, and I seem to remember it used to be quite competitive, with top climbers winning the jersey, like Claudio Chiappucci, Tony Rominger, Richard Virenque, but more recently, in the last 5-10 years or so, I would say, there's been a lack of interest in the jersey among teams. And if you look at this year's classification in particular, you know, I wouldn't say there are top climbers really going for the jersey. So I wondered what your thoughts are on that, and then what can be done to revive the interest in the polka dot jersey. Loving the podcast, and thank you very much. Keep up the great work.
Well, the French are the champions of the King of the Mountains at the moment. The last three winners are French: Romain Bardet, Julien Alaphilippe, Warren Barguil, all won in slightly different circumstances. I mean, Alaphilippe was kind of swashbuckling and won a couple of stages on his way to getting the jersey, as did Warren Barguil. Romain Bardet, it was a bit more of a sort of consolation prize for him last year, really.
Yeah, but the rules had changed as well a little from the previous years. Yeah, it's kind of, once again, I think it's been a consolation prize, the polka dot jerseys in recent years for the French, because they're unable to win the yellow, so there you are.
But I think, we've seen in this tour, the jersey has been held for so long by Benoît Cosnefroy, and the points on offer are really, really low until you get to the final week and the mountains come thick and fast. And I suppose it's balancing up, tempting somebody to target the jersey in the first couple of weeks with the risk that the jersey ends up being won by the yellow jersey anyway, as happened when Chris Froome won it in 2015, kind of by accident, just by dint of being up there. You want to try and tease that balance and have, it would be nice to think that, say, if Miguel Angel Lopez realises he can't win the Tour de France but could perhaps get on the podium in third place, then might come out and chase some points. But while the GC is kind of a consequence of keeping the GC so close, nobody wants to go off and waste their energy on King of the Mountains points while they're still a live threat in the GC.
Yeah, they haven't found the right balance at any time. I mean, when you had guys like Lucien Van Impe or you know, Richard
Herrera, Robert Miller, you know,
yeah, I mean,
the jersey had real prestige there.
Yeah, but the thing is, these guys knew they were not going to win the Tour, and so they really focused on they were absolute great climbers, and they knew that probably their only chance was to. It changed a little bit. I think that the first guys to kind of corrupt in a way the spirit of the polka dot jersey was maybe Laurent Jalabert, who won it by attacking early in the big mountain stages to score as many points as he could in the early climbs and then fade. So they try to avoid. That's the way a lot of the French. Thomas Vöckler did the same, you know, applied the same methods.
So they changed the rules.
Yeah, so they changed the rules. but by doing that, they went back to the old times when and then Chris Froome won it because the obviously in the if you put many points on the main climbs, that's when the leaders actually make a difference, and you find yourself in the same position with Chris Froome winning it, like in the past Hino or Merckx also won it. So they're really struggling to find the right balance. I don't know what the solution would be. Maybe
it's Strava.
Well, we've said this before, haven't we? If it was done just on the climbing times and with an accumulation of climbing times on the mountains, you would find out who the quickest climber was.
That'd be more interesting as well.
It would be, probably, yeah. It would be. I also think that, you know, the King of the Mountains competition in the Tour de France, I mean, we're the ones that called it the King of the Mountains. It's the Grand Prix de la Montagne, or the Meilleur Grimpeur, the best climber, isn't it? But the reason it has so much kind of, appeal, the romanticism of it, is purely the jersey design, really. The white with the red dots is...
And romanticism to climbing mountains as well.
Yeah, but I don't think you look at the
hand in hand.
You don't look at the Giro's mountains jersey with quite the same sense of of it
but
being.
It's also, I think, part of the legendary climbers of the past. We made that point very often that the pure climbers rarely win the Tour, and when you get guys like Bahamontes, Van Impe, or even Virenque in a way. I mean, these guys were pure climbers. Their only chance to express themselves was by winning the Polka dot jersey, even if two of them won the Tour.
You've made the point, Francois, before that pure climbers don't win the Tour, and that it's the riders who win the Tour, and especially win the Tour more than once, are time trialists who can climb. And that's Primoz Roglic.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, somebody actually sent me a message today suggesting that Bernal fell into that category of being too much of a pure climber and therefore perhaps not a multiple Tour de France winner.
Yeah, that's a good point. Just to go back to the previous question about quizzes and tie it in with the King of the Mountains, when I was at secondary school in the first year in French, something that still burns today, actually, in French lesson, one of the questions was...
Où est la piscine?
No. Well, it was that as well. C'est là-bas. One of the questions was, what jersey does the leader of the Tour de France wear? And I've obviously put yellow jersey, le maillot jaune, spelt it all out. This is like the first year at school. And I think her name was Julie Sanderson, said the white with red dots. And that was given as the correct answer.
Julie,
I was,
if you're listening. Lionel's still hurting.
Next question.
Hello, Richard, Lionel and Francois. This is Catherine Elliott, friend of the podcast from Sydney, Australia. I've always loved the rider diaries you include in your podcasts, and they frequently give a perspective on the race that is intimate, revealing and often unexpected. And it's such a great idea to extend the quantity of diaries this year when physical distancing rules must make it hard to gain access to riders. However, I'm always surprised at how many riders you get to keep diaries and how diligent they are in their recordings. I would have thought that after a day of such physical exertion, together with stress and responsibility, the last thing they would want was the commitment of keeping an audio diary. So I wondered, how do you pitch the audio diaries to riders? Do you have a good strike rate, or do many people say no? Do you pay the riders for their contribution? And do you find there's much interference from the teams in the tour diaries, with press officers or team managers wanting to screen rider outputs? Thanks for the excellent tour coverage. It's been a cracking race this year.
Thank you, Catherine, for the question. It's a great question. This started a few years ago with Joe Dombrowski, didn't it? At the Giro, we asked him to keep an audio diary for us. And he did a very kind of quirky job. It was quite esoteric and unusual, but very entertaining diary. I think Ian Boswell then kept a diary for us at the Tour de France. Did we get anybody else in the interim to do diaries? I can't remember now. But it really was something we built upon before the Vuelta last year when we asked James Knox and Nick Schultz to keep audio diaries. One part of your question was, how do we pick people? I mean, Joe Dombrowski and Ian Boswell were riders we knew quite well, and we thought they would do a really good job, as they did. Nick Schultz and James Knox, I'd met James in Girona and found him very thoughtful and interesting and thought he would be good. Nick Schultz featured in an episode of Kilometre Zero, didn't he, the previous year, and he had a very interesting story that he told extremely well.
It was just a hunch, wasn't it, that he'd be able to talk to himself effectively. Well, I mean, he's talking to the listeners, isn't he? But it's quite a jump to do that, I think, sitting in your hotel room or on the team bus, imagining that you're talking to sort of one person but also a whole bunch of people at the same time. And they did a fantastic job, the pair of them.
They really did. They really committed to it. We told them that they didn't have to, you know, send us in something every day, but they did. And I felt like it's interesting because I feel like they take sort of ownership of it and feel a sort of responsibility to really make it interesting and insightful. And we built upon that again at this year's Tour de France because of the situation and our fears that we wouldn't find it as easy to interview riders, which we haven't really. And so we spoke to 9 riders and 1 DS, some of them known quite well to us, others not so well. Again, it was a bit of a... Well, each one was quite carefully chosen. I mean, Jens Kukkelaer did a podcast recently with Mitch Docker. He's a great talker. Nikias Arndt is somebody I've found to be very interesting on the sort of mechanics of a race and his role as a road captain. Pavel Sivakov, he listens to the podcast and has told us that, and so we thought he would engage with it. And when I asked him about doing one, he was actually really grateful for the opportunity, I would say. He said that his coaches always told him to keep a diary and this would be the excuse to do that. And so he's the one actually who's committed the most to it. He sent us in something every day. I could pick out other names. Michael Morkov has been brilliant at really taking it seriously, trying again to give us insights into his race and his team's race.
And the riders and staff, well, we've got Tom Southam as well, EF Pro Cycling Sports Director. There's been a bit of a balance, hasn't there? Some have sent stuff in without us prompting. Some have preferred to have a question asked and have engaged fully with those questions. And I suppose we chose a number of people because the Tour de France is a... You know, when I think back to the Vuelta last year, what if, you know, Nick Schultz or James Knox had pulled out of the race in the first week? We'd have had no diarists left. So with the COVID situation, we thought we needed to have, you know, people spread across a number of teams. I think, you know, almost half the teams in the peloton we've got representation from. We've obviously only lost so far Sam Bewley from Mitchelton Scott, which has been fortunate. Well, unfortunate for Sam Bewley, of course. But, you know, we had to make sure that we would still have people in the race in the final week. And so I think, well, the quantity of material that they've sent in, we will turn into something after the tour. Because we haven't managed to use all of it.
Not at all. Lucas Postelberg has been really good as well, sending lots of stuff in. Simon Geschke is really engaged with it too. I'm not naming everybody. Do we pay them, was one of Catherine's questions. The answer is that we have in the past always paid them. We aren't paying them this year as such, but we are sending them lovely gifts. A Stacey Snyder Tour de France mug. They will each get one of those, which we think is a nice gift to give. I think in these kind of special circumstances, we've had to spread our net a bit wider. And teams and indeed riders have sort of understood that. And we're very grateful to them for engaging with it in the way that they have.
And just on Catherine's last point about, you know, interference from PR people, well, there hasn't been any. I mean, I think the only difference with an audio diary is that you kind of you put out the question and then you take back whatever the answer is. Where if you have a face-to-face conversation with somebody and they don't really answer the question first time round, you can ask the same question a slightly different way until you kind of get something.
I think there are obvious flaws with it. You know, if say one of the writers in our one of our audio diaries, if a writer on their team was busted for doping, for example, well, we would obviously ask them about that and want them to talk about that. But ultimately, it's on their terms, and that's the thing that makes it really good, but can also in that circumstance be a problem.
So I agree with that.
You know, there are pluses and minuses. It's not going to be a substitute for interviews, and we've done interviews face to face and over the phone at this tour. Next year, hopefully, it will return to something approaching normality.
It's a great sort of, you know, to give a sort of three-dimensional coverage of the tour. It is great to hear the perspective, and as lots of people have commented, there's a sort of intimacy between, you know, somebody talking into their phone, having thought about what they're going to say, knowing that people will be listening. But it really sort of takes you into their hotel room or onto the team bus or wherever it is they're recording.
James Knox at the Vuelta last year, he had such an interesting race, and he really did share that with our listeners, which was fantastic. And I feel that Pavel Sivakov's done that, actually, because, you know, he had a difficult start, a couple of crashes, and he sort of shared that. And so has Ryan Gibbons, who I didn't mention earlier, but he also has had a tough time and has shared that in a way that he might not have done had we been standing in front of him with a microphone outside the bus. You know, he might have been more guarded in that scenario. One more question.
When a breakaway is gone and isn't going to get caught, why do individual teams continue to put in effort at the front of the peloton rather than making other teams share the effort?
I've actually got one other question as well. Is there or are there plans for a women's Tour de France? I guess I've actually got one other question as well. Is, are women permitted to race for a team in the standard Tour de France as it is now, given that it's an endurance race rather than, you know, a short sprint race?
Well, two questions there from Andy. With regards to the first one, it's something that flummoxes people maybe watching the Tour de France for the first time. Sometimes, why does a team sit in the front? And we asked this question ourselves of UAE Team Emirates when they had Christophe in the yellow jersey on day two, and it was not a stage where he was going to keep the jersey, but they continued to sit on the front. There's a sort of etiquette there.
And also a sense of pride that they have the yellow jersey to defend in that case. But then also, sometimes the team on the front is actually not trying to close the gap. They're just trying to hold the gap and keep it manageable. And then somebody else might take over towards the end. Often it's De Koenig Quickstep who have got, they're holding the gap and then will start to close the gap. Or Bora Hansgrohe maybe would hold the gap and then close the gap. It's just all about keeping the stage under control, really, and making sure that nothing gets so far ahead that it can't be brought back in by the finish. And that's a calculation that they're going through, kilometre by kilometre. And I think one aspect of it that I'd not really appreciated until a few years ago when I spoke to Bradley Wiggins about his day out on the stage that I think finished in Bourg-en-Bresse in 2007, where he was just out front all on his own. The tempo for the breakaway is often set by the bunch rather than the other way around. I mean, it can work both ways, but if the bunch is chasing, then the break has to go quicker. If the bunch backs off, the breakaway slows down. And that sounds kind of counterintuitive. The idea, you would think that the break is always trying to go as hard as possible, but it's not necessarily. They're trying to get as much up the road as they can without the break chasing them too hard.
It could also work the other way, though. I remember the stage a couple of years ago, Yelly Willis won in the Vuelta, where he was part of a very strong break, and they deliberately sort of backed off in the break, sort of lulling the peloton into a false sense of security.
Yeah, but it can work. It can work both ways around.
And then he won the stage.
But the idea that the break is setting the tempo always is not necessarily the case.
And it also the role of the team at the front changes during the stage, because if you have a man up front and you want and in his position to win the stage, then sometimes the team goes to the front to protect the lead of the breakaway so that that guy can win the stage. So, I mean, there are many different occurrences and many different strategies that push the team towards the front. There can also be echelons when, you know, wind, suddenly crosswind is coming to the stage. That's when you see the Belgian and the Dutch teams and well, at least they borrow Handkerchief as well, but Duncan in Quickstep are supposed to be the experts in that, you know, going to the front to try and surprise the other teams. So there are many ways. I've, in some of the boring stages, I've seen it a few times, not very often, teams reluctant to go to the front, and you find a team that's leading the way because nobody else wanted to do it. So, I mean, but there is to be, that since, you know, the team job, the job inside the team has become so important, in that there was probably a little bit less of it in the 1970s, and it started to come up more in the 80s and 90s. That you know, teams are riding together, you know, like in trains, like we mentioned in the past. Then obviously, team has to lead the way. Most of the time, is to defend the jersey. Most of the time, is to prepare for a bunch sprint if you have a good sprinter. But as we said, there might be different little reasons to do that.
I think I said Yelly Wallace before I have the pronunciation police on my back. The other question from Andy was about women's Tour de France. I think we half expected an announcement during this tour about a new race in 2022. We know it's going to happen, or certainly the ASO are planning for a week-long stage race to start. And we covered it a little bit in an episode of Kilometer Zero in week one, where we heard a few interviews with people, including a writer from Donon Desel and from the Internationales, who are groups of female riders who've been riding the Tour de France ahead of the men. The Donon Desel this year rode a month ahead of the men. But to get a bit more on this, I spoke earlier today to Lisa Kirkbright of Skoda. Now, full transparency, Skoda are sponsoring us at this tour in the shape of a magnificent blue car over there, our Kodiaq VRS. It's extremely nice, and it's been a great pleasure to travel around France in that.
With a good nest. Thanks for the nest.
Great nest. Thanks, Lisa, for the nest. But so they've sponsored us, but they've also sponsored, in particular, cycling podcast Femina over the last couple of years. And they're really pushing to promote women's cycling. And what interested me about that was that Skoda are also one of the major partners of the Tour de France. And I wondered if there was any kind of tension between that and their efforts to really force ASO to do a bit more for women's cycling. So I spoke to Lisa. I know it's a particular passion of hers. I spoke to her about that earlier.
When you look across each of the races that are out there for men and women, and from our own perspective, how we look at cycling, and essentially, we love cycling. We've got a big background in it. We've come directly from there. And we believe that everybody should be afforded the same opportunities. And when we look really closely at our partnerships, we spend a lot of time building up those rights partnerships. So we've got the Women's Tour and the Tour of Britain, where we can see for the first time we get parity in prize funds for both men and women. And that feels like that should be the normal. And then the more you look at it, the more you kind of say, actually, I'm not sure the women are getting the same opportunities. And we look at the number of elite riders, we look at the number of races. And I just think, for fairness, we should all be given that same opportunity. So when we come across people like the Internationales, who a bunch of women who work really hard, train really hard, have proper jobs and kids and lives, and they want to go out there and make some noise about that disparity, I feel really privileged to be in a position that we can support them and help them call that message out to the powers that be.
I mean, it's interesting because among the powers that be are ASO, of course, and as I say, Skoda are a main partner of ASO. Is there any tension there at all between that sort of campaign and Skoda's relationship with ASO and its status as a main partner?
No, not at all. There's absolutely, we are, you know, we watch the Tour de France. It's the coolest race. It's, you know, one of the biggest sporting events in the world each year. And we look at it and we celebrate it. And when we look to things like the La Course and we see some of the finest, most exciting races racing across that whole event, we kind of go, well, can we just have a bit more, please? Because actually this works really well. We know the commentators love it. We know that you guys watch it and you get so passionate about it and excited about it. I think, just wouldn't it be wonderful if we could do that more often and see more of it? And I think, you know, I don't specifically work with the ASO, but I know that the relationship our global team have with them is really positive, and we're always looking for ways to step things on, and we can see that more and more as the ASO sort of keep approaching that conversation, and each time we feel like there's a bit of progression being made, and I am hoping it's a matter of time now before we see a formal announcement to say, do you know what, let's see a female Tour de France in whatever name or guise it comes in. I'm super encouraged, and I'm so excited that, you know, what's happened here is people have been listened to. And I think that's by nature of the way that Donon Deshels and Internationales have made their message be heard. It's been a very passive show of support for women's racing. It's been a really positive message to everybody out there. And for us at Škoda, we've been delighted to be able to say, hey, there's some really important messaging going out here. Let's just help you amplify that message and share that story with the public. And what we've seen throughout is that men and women alike have been really supportive of that message. It's like a dad being able to tell his daughter that she can do the same as his son can do. And it's really positive inclusion that's really inspired us to be part of it. And it's, you know, we think back to Škoda's heritage, and we were born on two wheels, as we like to say. And back in 1895, as the company sets up as a bike company, a mere 4 years in, that company is realizing that they need to get women mobile as well. So how do we evolve bikes so that women can ride bikes? So it's been something that in Škoda's heritage has been about inclusivity since day dot.
So that was Lisa Kirkbright from Škoda. And I think that pretty much concludes our second press conference episode. Has it been a bit of a marathon? I think it has.
Some great questions. I mean, we didn't get to all the questions, and we did get a whole batch.
Not by any means.
We did get a whole batch of questions about concussion, the issue of concussion, especially following Romain Bardet's crash the other day. We're actually going to put those questions to some of our audio diarists and see what we can do before the end of the tour. But
yeah, we'll play the questions and the responses from our audio diarists and perhaps one or two other people as well, including doctors, before the end of the tour. Yeah, but we got loads and loads of questions, and sorry we couldn't get to them all. But it's been fun. I don't know how long we've been going for, because I broke off in the middle to go and interview Richard Pluger, the boss at Jumbo Visma, and hopefully we'll hear that interview later in the week as well.
Yeah, you did. I mean, it feels like...
Been here forever.
Yeah, must be nearly dinner time, Richard.
Okay, chaps, a quick thank you to some friends of the podcast. Okay, from me, a big thank you to Andy Lowther, Jamie McPherson, Alistair Seaton, Mark Labetz, Stephen Dodson, and B. Fagan.
And a big thank you from me to Sandy Legg, Raymond McHugh, Stephen Palmer, Mr. G.A. Jones, love that, Scott McFadden, and Tom Duncan.
And un grand merci to Adam Matthew Simpson, Wojtech Bubenik, Simon Barton, Mr. P.G. Griffith, Andrew Rigby, and Patrick Hawkins.
Thank you, Francois.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you.